Hello and welcome to the Daily Reprieve, where we provide essay speaker meetings, workshops, and conferences in podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast. If you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by going to donate.thedailyreprieve.com and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Please consider donating monthly by clicking the Donate Monthly button. However, one-time donations are always welcome. Just click the Donate Now button. Now, without further ado, this episode of The Daily Reprieve.
Hello, everybody. My name is Shim. I'm a grateful sexaholic and one of the admins of this group. If it's okay, I'd like to actually introduce today's recording, one of the wonderful gifts that God has given to our fellowship. And that is a sexaholic brother named Daniel T. And a few days ago, a great event has come to pass. The Big Book tells us that great events will come to pass for us and for countless others. And 6 years of sobriety for a brother of ours in this program, who actually was in this program many moons ago, left this program, was 12-stepped back into this program. And boy, are we all grateful that he got here just in time. Especially once COVID hit, and he's one of those individuals that carried our fellowship on his shoulders and continues to do so. So without further ado, I'd like to wish congratulations to Daniel on behalf of the entire fellowship. And here's his celebration talk that he gave a few days ago at his home group, 6 years of sobriety. Here's Daniel T.
20, we'll see how we do. Hi everyone, my name is Daniel. I'm a very grateful Covenant Sexaholic. I'm very grateful to say that I have sobriety today since the 16th of December 2016. This year was an interesting year. Closest I got to resetting my sobriety was this year. And it was a really good first step experience for me, and I'll talk about that in a bit. My MOs, masturbation, chronic masturbation. I first found, masturbation around the age of 6-7, and it was probably the most amazing thing that ever happened, that had ever happened and will ever happen to me. It was a dream, and I was hooked. Like hook, line, and sinker, completely and absolutely and utterly hooked. Just the physical feeling, the whole thing was just like out. It was out of this world. It really was. And I think from that moment on, like, I'd found my new best friend, and things were never the same ever since. And it progressed. So. The next thing was the erotic literature. Around the age of 10, I was always a big reader, but around the age of 10, I found some really good stuff on my mom's bookshelf. Like, really, really strong erotic literature that was just like, take, you know, like, sensationalized cocaine and orgies, basically. So I had a vision of what I wanted for the future, and I had now material to masturbate over, which was great. And then around the age of 12, someone gave me my first porn magazine, and that was it. That was like, yeah, that was just. Wow. I mean, that just blew my mind. It's nothing like, I mean, you know, I always joke and say about people that are addicted to pixels, it's nothing like the real thing, you know, which is the printed version. You know, real magazines are not, you know, you can't compare it. I mean, it's the glossiness, you can't get that on a monitor. You know, VR goggles got kind of close, but that was also not. Well, it was 30 years later, and even that wasn't to the high definition level. And then, at the age of 14, out of nowhere, this girl who was like two or three years, about 2 years older than me. She just walked up to me and she said, pardon me for a minute, and basically stuck her tongue in my mouth and French kissed me. And that was it. And I thought, like, up until that point, this is like, this was it. And then, wow, this, now I was really home. The French kiss was like, that was like, that was probably the most, you know, incredible experience of my entire life. And the fact that she'd been dared to do it, I did not give a flying crap. Had nothing, you know, it was not emotional. I'd already had kind of like, girlfriend experiences, like, you know, emotional kind of girlfriends at my, a year earlier, my bar mitzvah. There was this girl that I'd been having this kind of emotional love affair with for a while. And you've got this cute, you got to see this video of me like slow dancing at the age of 13. I'm like really small and very, and just like, you know, like holding on to her for dear life with the slow dance, you know, after we did the horror or whatever it was, the Hava Nagina stuff. the later, you know, slow dancing to whatever it was, George Michael or Whitney Houston. So I'd already experienced the emotional side of things. But now this was the sexual side of things. And I was hooked, again, hooked, line, and sinker. And from that point, it was just a very big cycle of, for those next four plus years of doing my darnest to try and hook up with every single girl that I could. Having emotional affairs with lots of other girls that wouldn't hook up with me emotionally, physically. A lot of marijuana smoking and a lot of, quite a bit of gambling as well. Poker playing. Anything I did obsessively. There was a year and a half period where I played backgammon. With a friend of mine, we played backgammon straight, and I'd go to the movies, and all I could see on the big screen was like this giant backgammon board. You know, like just, you know, when you do something so much, so you see, is the pieces moving, and I'd like turn to my buddy and say, I just rolled a 6-5. You know, like I am just an obsessive addict, and I do everything obsessively to just get that next hit. Around the age of 17 actually, a bunch of us went down to Soho in London, and it was some kind of prank stuff going on over there. I didn't fully understand what was going on, but basically, I think the idea was that there was this thing called a rent boy. I didn't know what that was, and they wanted me to be the rent boy, and then we were going to like take the guy around the back and beat him up and take his money, and I didn't, I was like very naive with everything I did. Thank God no one picked me up. I mean, really. But there was a lot of flashing lights and shops selling porn and paraphernalia. And I was like, wow, this is like, you know, my second home over here. What the hell's going on? And for them, it was like, you know, although, you know, most of my friends, we were all a bunch of addicts, but it definitely affected me differently. And I went back there a few days later, and I found myself in the grottiest, most disgusting, smelly room. And I bought sex for the first time. And even though it was, disgusting and gross, I was hooked. I was hooked, line, and sinker. Buy sex. Wow. What I need is money and I can get sex. Done. Game over. And so there you go. My new MO was now prostitutes. And I would work to get prostitutes and then work to gamble and work to buy my weed. I didn't have much money left after all this. My money was spent. I was already experiencing that insanity of like of the thought coming into my brain and then being powerless over any of it until I actually acted it out. Just totally powerless until I got that prostitute. It was a cycle. It was a cycle that just repeated itself over and over and over. And that alongside porn, alongside a quick kind of trying to bag girls for, not for money because it was easier. And I felt like that, you know, I felt like my sexualism was smelly in the sense that they could smell it a mile away and they weren't really interested in a guy who was only interested in sex. Then I became religious around the age of, after going to college, having a psychotic breakdown, which involved me having a spiritual experience, masturbating with God. Literally, you know, for me, the spiritual experience was a masturbation extravaganza. It was like a 2 or 3 hour masturbation with God appearing and being there, part of it. It was really powerful, but that's that's what happens when you're the real deal. You're a sexaholic of the hopeless variety. I definitely didn't have any guilt around masturbation. I left college, went back to college for the sake of the free credit card debt that I was given. Took a bunch of friends to Amsterdam on that free credit card debt that was given to me by the new college that I went to. And of course, while they were, you know, smoking, I was smoking and also going to visit prostitutes. And then became religious somehow and moved to Israel at the age of 21. And I didn't fully, I kind of like had this thing in the back of my mind, like, there was always that part of me that kind of wanted to stop, but it owned me in such a totally overwhelming fashion that it was not really an option. I remember, so it was literally day two or day three, of me having landed in Israel, and I came with literally nothing. I came with a suitcase of clothes, a suitcase of books, and like £20 in my pocket. And I remember sitting on Kikot Zion back in the day when it was the steps going down in front of the bank. For those that might remember the steps in front of Kikot Zion, in front of the bank there. And there was this girl sitting opposite me. And it appeared that she wasn't wearing underwear at the time. And, any promise that I'd made to myself to like start fresh. And be, you know, like that promise when you move to a new house, you say, I'm not going to masturbate in this house. You know, it's just like, this house is going to be such insanity. Like, what's going to change? Like, you didn't do anything. Nothing's going to actually change. But that was it. So any promise and oath or whatever it was that I'd made to myself that I was now going to stop doing any of these behaviors, that was it. It was kicked into, lust took over. And I didn't have internet. Still, I'd never even experienced the internet. Didn't have money for prostitutes, and I was living in Jerusalem, and I didn't speak the language. Hadn't yet found classified ads for where to find prostitutes in Jerusalem, which took me at least a year or so. So lust took it. You know, it's the whack-a-mole that Roy talks about in the White Book. It has to come out somehow. So it came out on the streets. It came out on buses. It came out in shops, in touching, in following, all kinds of like deviant angles. Because lust needed an outlet, and it wasn't just getting. It wasn't anymore getting its like, you know, safe porn prostitute outlet. Jumping forwards. So lust in the street as an MO owned me. I mean, it was just, and it had been a long time of lust in the street because, you know, I remember traveling the underground tube in London and, just always being owned by the lust, and that was also the lust, wanting to be lusted after, piece as well of my MO was always just like, is she looking at me? Is she attracted to me? Am I attracted to her? That always that trying to make a spiritual connection with the other person on the train. I used to call it people watching. Little did I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the denial of active sexaholism, of active addiction, is pretty powerful because it leads to denying your own character defects, it leads to denying to justifying behaviors, it leads to so much insanity. Had a very quick marriage with what was potentially a sexaholic, which didn't work out so well. And the marriage ended very quickly, after 5 months. And then a few months later, I met my wife, and it was a perfect match. Match made in heaven. She asked me, do I like sex, before we got married? I said, oh, yeah, I like sex. Like, do I like sex? What kind of question is that? You ask a sexaholic, do I like sex? I mean, seriously, yes, I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is it. This is the marriage made in heaven. And I was very emotionally and mentally and sexually immature. And thus started a marriage of pretty much the next MO, which was lust in the bedroom and abusing my wife, treating her as a sex object, manipulating sex out of her, doing whatever I could to get sex, making sex the most important thing in our marriage, having sex when she didn't want it, basically raping her, giving her a nightmare if she didn't give me sex, attitude, anger, rage. Added to that, of course, was the constant smoking, whiskey on Shabbos, which caused more rage, and my workaholism, which took over from my gambling addiction. So I was an absent husband, absent father, which kind of worked out well for her for those years, because that was her story. She was like happy to be, you know, for me to not be around. And of course, then, you know, I would look at the clock. It's been a week. What's going on? It's time. Time to have sex. You know, where's my present? Which really doesn't make for a very strong relationship emotionally. Makes for a very sick relationship emotionally. And throughout that period, so I started doing my wife really, really big favors and going to prostitutes, because then I didn't need to take sex from her. Only once or twice a month I needed to take sex from her, instead of like demanding all the time, because when things really got bad, I would just, you know, I'm doing her a favor, go to her. And of course, then the MO of sexual tourism kicked in as a workaholic, getting on the plane, flying to the States for conferences, and the entire time on the trip just being, you know, I'm not going to do it. I don't even know where that came from, that side of it. I mean, I skipped the part where at 1 year of marriage, we went to a couples a therapist who's very well known in recovery today, and he took one look at me and said, you're a sex addict, you need to go to SA. And I really needed it, but I didn't want it, so nothing happened, nothing changed. So I guess there was some sort of whatever it is, the blue pill that I'd taken. Like, the Matrix had already been open to me, but I wasn't still in complete denial, so I wasn't aware of that. So then, yeah, it wasn't filling me. Nothing was filling up that desperate need for connection inside of me. Nothing was, and I was just searching for it in all the wrong places. And I really wanted to get it from my wife. I stopped. I really wasn't into the prostitute thing anymore. For me, it was just that. It was the physical. I would go to massages, and I would even close my eyes and just imagine that with my wife giving it to me. I just wanted that that physical, emotional experience and the physicality, but nothing was doing it. It was a God-sized hole that could never, ever, ever be filled. Ever. Nothing was going to fill it. And so it progressed in its own way. In other words, I needed more and more of it. There was it got to the point where, this is my story, where me and my buddy, who's also pretty much a sexaholic, we worked together every day in my office. He came to me and told me about this thing called NoFap, where you basically have this whole community of people out there that think that masturbating and porn isn't good for you, and you should take a 90-day break from it. So I was like, wow, this is really interesting. You know, I'm going to try and do a 90-day break from porn. And even though I said, masturbation, come on, that's taking it too far. But what I do is, like, anytime I really need to go and I've got this urge to go to a prostitute or something, I'll allow myself to masturbate to a blank wall. I'll do the no porn thing. And I noticed something. I think I pulled off nearly 90 days of no porn. And it was basically the beginning of my recovery, because I'd started to break that craziness. What I noticed was that at the same time that I was not porning, I'd started to watch out for Lust on the Street, and that the two were so closely intertwined between the porn and the street lust that I couldn't carry on with the street lust and break the porn. I had to quit both. Then a few times, basically afterwards, everything had become really much more, like, to the point I was getting ready for recovery. I felt a porn a few times. My usage really went way down. I mean, it used to be nightly. I was desperate. I went away on a work trip, and I was desperate to do that work trip sober. Sober, I mean, not using the word sober, but to not act out with paid massage. And I had perfect sobriety for 3 days, and on the fourth morning my legs walked me to a massage parlor, and I was like, where the frick are you going? What is going on? And then I came home and I was desperate for give me a couple minutes, okay? I was desperate to finish this off, to break this, and at the same time all I wanted was the next fix. And I needed that next fix. And I was desperate I found a massage parlor here in Beit Shemesh, finally, my dream. And it turned out to be this 70-year-old lady with a really bad flu. And and I went for it. And that was the last paid sexual massage that I had, thank God. It was a good memory to keep at the forefront of my first step. And then literally, I think 2 days later, my wife turned to me and she said, I don't care if we ever have sex again, I'm done. You can do what you like. You can divorce me. You can stay with me. I don't care. I'm done. And of course, the tears start rolling down my face. What do you mean? No sex? What are you talking about? We're working this out. And I tried desperately in so many hundreds of ways to fix this. The problem was me. I was the problem. And I woke up the next morning. And I logged on to this, to Guard Your Eyes, which had been in the background of my memory from a while before. And I just started reading and reading and reading and reading and reading. And I was reading all these posts from Dov, all these 12 step posts, all these posts from Sexaholics in Recovery. And I just started reading and reading and reading. And I had a spiritual experience that morning. And I haven't looked back since. And as I mentioned, this year has been a tougher year. We went away for Pesach, and for 3 days in a row, I didn't do my morning prayers. I didn't give my day to God. I didn't say thanks for yesterday's sobriety. I didn't ask for help to be sober today. And on the fourth day, thanks to a few tequilas and a pool, people hanging around the pool, I started. And I saw that exact moment. I noticed it. That I said, wow, this is the first time I've looked sexually at a woman in 5.5 years. It was the first time I actually felt it. And it was sickening. I felt sick from the whole thing. And I was so grateful because I've listened to so many talks and so much. I've heard and drunk so much sobriety that there was no shame and there was no guilt, because that's what I am. I am a sexaholic, and if I don't take my daily medicine, I will act out. I will lust. That's what I do. That's normal for me. My norm is to lust, and I need my daily medicine. As long as I take my daily medicine, I have a daily reprieve. And for me, that daily medicine includes sponsoring, includes thanking God for yesterday's sobriety and asking for help today's sobriety. And most importantly, it includes that 11-step prayer. Give me guidance for what you want me to do next and give me the power to carry it out. And that's it. That's what I do on a daily basis. Ask God for power to carry out his will. And I try and be useful and helpful. Keep the insides out. Speak to my sponsor nearly every day. And come to meetings at least 2 a week. And I do service. And I have fellowship with you guys. And thank you for letting me share.
I would like to thank you for listening to this episode of The Daily Reprieve, the best source for experience, strength, and hope for SA members. Please subscribe to this podcast to be alerted of new episodes. Please show your support by donating to The Daily Reprieve by going to donate.thedailyreprieve.com and choosing either monthly donations or a one-time donation by clicking Donate Now. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Daily Reprieve.